Welcome to WBAI. I'm Michael Zweig. Why a conference on class right now?
Well, class is an important part of our lives, and in this country we've sort of lost track of that in the public discourse. We have a lot of attention to race and a lot of attention to gender, and those are all important things. But in that great triumvirate of race, class, and gender, class has kind of fallen on the wayside.
And before we go any further, what exactly do you mean by class?
Well, for me, class is a question of power. And some people think about class as income. You know, you have a middle class with middling incomes, and then you have the rich at the top and the poor at the bottom. Or people think of class as lifestyle. You know, some people have class, and, you know, that has to do with what kind of food they eat or what kind of manners they have or
bowling
whatever.
Bowling
versus polo or whatever. And I don't think that it's very useful. Of course, there are differences in income and differences in lifestyle and what people do for pastimes and so on. But I think that the central feature of class is power, the power at work or not so much power at work. And from those power relations on the job and in the basic economy extends out from there power relations in politics and power in the culture and media and so on and so forth. And when I talk about the working class, I mean people who don't have a lot of power. They don't have a lot of authority when they go to work. They have a job and they're shown the job, they do the job, and then they go home. But they don't supervise anybody, they're not the boss, and they don't have a lot of control over the pace or the content of their work. So we're talking about cashiers, basic writers of computer code, people who are driving trucks, people who are medical technicians, or people working in home health care. Those are working class people. In the United States, about 62% of the labor force is working class people. The capitalists are only 2% of the labor force, of people in the economy. And then the middle class of professional people and small business owners and managerial supervisory personnel, that's about 36% of the labor force. So we are a society that is by far a majority of working class people, and class, because it is power, is a relationship. You can't have power all by yourself, or you can't be powerless all by yourself. You have power or not in relation to other people. So you have a working class which is relatively powerless in society, not completely, especially if people get together and they have unions or common political action. But as a class, working people don't have a whole lot of power. But that's in relation to the capitalist class that does have rather a lot of power. Now, they don't have total power. They can't do everything. But relatively, the powerful are the capitalists. The relatively powerless are workers. And in between is the middle class, which is in the middle not of income or wealth. The question of the middle class, what are they in the middle of? They're in the middle of this power grid of labor and capital, the working class and the capitalist class.
So far you've been giving a lot of weight to the workplace or one's position in the labor market or one's ownership or lack of ownership of property, fairly traditional definitions of class. Now, there are people who said, especially a few years ago, I think I don't hear as much of this anymore, but people said, you know, this is a consumer society and people don't necessarily define their social positions around their place in the labor market or their ownership of property. What do you say to
that? Well, two things. First of all, how people actually define themselves. There's a story that everybody thinks of themselves as middle class. Well, it depends how you ask the question. If you do a survey and you say, well, to people, what class are you? Are you upper class, middle class, lower class? Where do you fit in that? Most people will say that they're middle class because most people don't particularly want to be the lower class, and most people know that they're not the upper class, so that's middle, is what's left. But you change the result if you give people working class as an option. Now, if you change the question and say, what class are you, upper class, middle class, working class, lower class? 55 or 60% of the American people will say working class. And that's true if we're just looking at white people, or just looking at African Americans, or just looking at women or men. And that's actually not too far off from what the reality is, where 62% is the working class. So I think that, you know, American people are certainly ready to talk about class and the working class. So that's one part of this business of people being a consumer society. Now, of course, it is true that people think about themselves in terms of their consumption. You know, you are what you have. And there is an idea, and it's certainly true even in the labor movement among union officials, that they like to say that they make their members middle class, by which they mean that they can buy things, that they can have their own home, they can, you know, if a worker is working in a steel mill or is a sanitation worker here in New York, they make decent money and they can have a car, they can have their own house, they can live in the suburbs, they can, you know, go on vacation. And because they have a stable existence, that is supposed to be like the middle class. Well, in a certain way, it's like the middle class in 1945. But if you look at what the middle class consumes today, what the working class can consume doesn't really reach what the middle class can consume. They really do have different levels of income and wealth and capacity. Even if people do think of themselves through their consumption, you know, they want to have a nice car, they get sold, you know, identification and personal identification with possessions, and you know, you go shop till you drop kind of thing. That's certainly there, but it's not at all clear that people aren't also ready to talk about class directly as related to work and related to power in society. And I think that that's a conversation we really do need to have clearly, openly, and let's see where it goes.
I'm speaking with Michael Zweig, professor of economics at State University of New York, Stony Brook, and organizer of a conference going on right now as we speak at Stony Brook on how class works. There is a group for the Center of for the Study of Working Class Life,
right,
at Stony Brook. Also, many people at the conference, many like-minded people at the conference. What kinds of approaches, academic, disciplinary approaches, do you have to the subject?
Well, what we have at Stony Brook is a group for the study of working class life, and it's 45 or 50 faculty and professional staff at the university who are interested in these issues of class and who use class in the way they understand their own work and their own lives. Mostly in the social sciences, we have people in history, in political science, sociology, economics, anthropology, philosophy, some people in the sciences too, in physics and chemistry, women's studies, Africana studies, school social welfare. So there's really quite a very broad range. And one of the things that's quite interesting and I think very heartening about the mix of people is that it really is black and white and Asian and Hispanic and men and women and senior faculty and graduate students and fresh PhDs and people who aren't teachers but who are lab technicians or administrative assistants or people who work in the admissions office but who understand their position at work as faculty or as staff through the lens of class, and they are active in the union. We have a union at State University for faculty and professional staff, United University Professions, UUP, and the union is supporting the conference. We have union members not only from the AFT, but also from CWA, from Unite, from quite a number of different unions who are here at the conference, who've sent people who are here speaking, who are here listening and learning, together with the academics. So it's really quite a mix of people by background and by race and ethnicity and gender trying
and
to come
not
to grips.
Your typical academic conference.
It's not your typical academic conference. We have people coming to the conference from South Africa, from Australia, from England, from Canada, and from all over the United States.
Now, you've said a couple things in that comment that I want to explore. First of all, race and class, but also gender and class, and ethnicity and nationality and class. I mean, people in intellectual life, cultural life, political life, over the last two or three decades have really focused a lot of attention on what the theorists call non-class modes of identity, race, gender, sexual preference. And then there are some kind of antediluvian lefties who will say, you know, we need to get past all this stuff and get back to class. How do you navigate that set of issues?
Well, I first of all, I wouldn't want to say let's get past all of that, because we have learned a great amount and important things to know about race and gender and the importance of ethnicity and how these things operate in our lives. The meaning of racism, the meaning of sexism and male chauvinism, and also the meaning of liberation struggles around those questions from people who are demanding their equality and freedom. And I don't in any way think that it's right to say, well, oh, that's all tut tut, let's not worry about those things, let's really get down to business here and talk about class. Not at all. I think that, however, class is an element of our lives every bit as much as race and gender. And race and gender are themselves shaped by class. The black community is obviously a community that's driven by class. So we have class structure within race, and we obviously have it also within gender. There are women who are in the capitalist class, not many, and within that class, not the most powerful. But nonetheless, there are class variations within gender, and there are gender variations within class. So what we have in the way that we're talking about it at this How Class Works conference is the mosaic of race, class, and gender. How do these things interact and inform one another? But I think that in that discussion, just as it's important not to lose sight of race and gender and what we've learned in those struggles and in those investigations, I think we don't want to reduce class to either insignificance or itself to just another category of race and gender. So I think what we're trying to do is to understand that element of our lives, class, that is rooted in the economic structures and the economic experience, but then has its implications in the culture and in politics, and in issues of race and gender and affirmative action and many other kinds of questions. And that's what we're trying to do.
And the other thing you said before I want to pick up on is the international dimension.
Yeah.
Production has, or economic life has been substantially internationalized. It's really not newly so, but it's been more so in recent decades. And we, I think, increasingly see community of interest and institutions, institutional ties developing among the elites globally. Is class really something no longer that occurs within national boundaries? Is this really acquiring an international dimension?
Well, I think both things are true. I think, let me be careful here. I think that class operates on an international dimension, but I think that it is not true to say it does not operate domestically. Class obviously operates within economies and certainly within the United States. Some people make the claim that globalization, for example, means that governments are irrelevant and only capital is relevant. I don't think that that's true. I think governments are very important because governments have armies. And in the end, as we used to say on the streets of Detroit where I grew up, oh yeah, you and what army? And that happens that General Motors and Halliburton and these large corporations that are global in scope do have an army, and that's the U.S. Army. And they might put together a coalition of forces from here and from there, but those are nation states. And within the nation state, within our own, for example, those questions of government policy and government action around the world are very much part of class conflict and class struggle.
And that's the voice of Michael Zweig, a professor of economics at State University of New York in Stony Brook and organizer of a conference going on right now at that university on how class works. Let's talk a bit about, break down the capitalist class a little more finely. Let's make some distinctions. We've got, you know, somebody who owns a small dry cleaner,
right,
is a capitalist in some sense. Then you've got, you know, a self-employed professional who might appear to be well off, but, you know, it may not be a capitalist in the conventional sense. Then you have the CEO of General Motors.
Right.
So, you know, who are all these people?
Well, the first thing that you're pointing to is that there's a great variation in each of these classes, in the capitalist class, but also in the middle class. There's a variation from professionals who are big-time lawyers in white-shoe corporate law firms to, you know, people who are working in four-year colleges as teachers. They're all in the middle class. It's a big range. You can have, within the working class, too, people who are working for minimum wage or less, who are part of the working class and people who are have good union jobs and, you know, who are making, with lots of overtime, $80,000 or $100,000 a year, still in the working class, sanitation worker in New York City, for example. So there is variation in all these classes, and that variation is interesting to talk about, but I think it shouldn't mean that we conclude that, oh, because there's all this variation, class doesn't really mean anything, and we're all just individuals. I think that's not the right conclusion to draw from that variation. I think despite the variation within classes, there's enough of a difference across them to justify saying that there is a difference between the capitalist class, the middle class, and the working class in terms of power and in terms of their basic position in society. So if we come to the capitalist class in particular, well, you talked about somebody who's got a dry cleaning shop. Now, you find somebody who owns the shop, maybe he's got one or two people working there. I would say that if that person owns it in some formal way, that's a capitalist, if they have some employees. But I put small businesses into the middle class and only larger businesses into the capitalist class, into as full capitalist enterprises. And so now we have to say, well, what's the difference between a big and a small, and how do we make this distinction? Where do we draw the line? Well, there's a certain arbitrariness at the border, exactly where you draw the line, but here's what I did, and here's how I would say is a reasonable way to think about it. If you have somebody who owns a shop, and they work in the shop, and they work right alongside with the people, and they supervise the people who they employ, that's like a person who owns a dry cleaning shop. Not a chain of dry cleaning stores, but owns a dry cleaning shop or a bodega or a contracting firm, and they're out, you know, working at the sites and supervising and going off to some other place, but they're basically involved in the production process directly. I would say that person is maybe a small business owner and part of the middle class. Once the owner is no longer directly involved in production, but is elevated away from production and is now just doing the strategic planning and the management of and the actual operation of the enterprise, of the work, is handled by some intermediate level of management, now we got a capitalist enterprise. And so then the question is, well, at what point does an enterprise become big enough so that the owner isn't likely to be on the floor, but is likely to have this intermediate level of management? And I looked at some, you know, studies of management methods and business organization literature, and talked to people, and looked also at the Commerce Department data. And the cutoff I take is 20 people. If you employ more than 20 people, you're a capitalist enterprise. In the United States, we have 21 million businesses. If you look at the Internal Revenue Service, IRS data, 21 million businesses file returns every year. Most of them are Schedule C individuals who have just their own little business, whatever it is, like a consultant or somebody who's just doing their own thing. Of the 21 million businesses, something like 15 million have no employees. Of those 21 million businesses, about 800,000, 850,000 have more than 20 employees. All right, so right away, we're talking about in the business world, a rather small fraction are capitalist businesses. But even there, there's a tremendous variation. And so if you can have 100 employees, and if you're in Murdo, South Dakota, you got yourself a big shop, and you're really a big cheese in the place because it's a small town. But if you got 100 employees and you're in Queens, or you have 100 employees, and you're in Detroit, it's not that big of a deal. So, and certainly not on a national scale. So if we want to talk about what's the capitalist class on a national scale, that would have power not just in a local area, not just in the community as the sort of local powers, but the capitalist class sort of for the United States, then I want to say, well, now let's talk about what does the government and the capitalist class itself say about who's big business and who's not. Well, the government has, through the Department of Commerce, the Small Business Administration. So who's small